You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Marcus Collins. Marcus is an award-winning marketer and cultural translator. He is the head of strategy at Wieden Kennedy, New York, and a clinical assistant professor of marketing at the Ross School of Business, the University of Michigan. He's got a great new book. It's called For the Culture, The Power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Marcus Collins, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm stoked to be here.
So a sweet spot for me has always been the intersection of my career as a creative executive at Second City and my immersion in behavioral science, neuroscience, and other areas of study. And you write in your new book, quote, "The marriage of academia and practice has been the biggest cheat code in my career because it unlocked an unequivocal truth. If you want to get people to move, there is no vehicle more powerful or more influential than culture, full stop," end quote. All right, let's unpack that, because culture is a loaded word, or maybe a word that people don't give much credence to, and they should.
Yeah, it's a word that we use colloquially, so it's a part of our normal vernacular, and we sort of like kind of we use it willy-nilly. And not to undermine our use of the word, it's just I think that if we had a better understanding of what culture is, not only would we give it more more credence and more respect to its gravitas, but also we'd have more agency to navigate the world. Because as the quote said, to your point, that there's no external force more influential to human behavior than culture. And the better we understand it and the mechanisms that make up culture, the more likely we are to navigate it and perhaps even leverage its power to get people to adopt behavior, which is super powerful if you are invested in getting people to move.
I thought one of the wise things that my friend Melissa Daimler said, she's at Udemy, and she says culture is happening in your organization whether you are doing anything about it or not.
That's right.
So right. That's a very sobering idea.
Yeah. I mean, culture is like, it's hard for us to put into words, and scholars have, you know, waxed poetic about what it is and how it's hard to define because it's so omnipresent. It's in everything that we do. It's like explaining water to a fish. It's in everything. One scholar writes that the mind cannot operate independent of culture, whether we're cognizant of it or not. I mean, culture, it is the governing operating system of humanity. It is, as Durkheim fashions it, it's the system of conventions and expectations to demarcate who we are and what people like us ought to do. And whether we are aware of it or not, our behaviors are influenced by culture. What we buy, where we go, what we do, how we dress, where we marry, if we marry, who we marry, where we go to school, if we go to school, how we bury the dead, if we bury the dead, where we vacation, where we eat. All these things are byproducts of our cultural subscription. Culture moves forward on the basis of a simple question. Do people like me do something like this? The answer is yes, I do it. The answer is no, I don't. And hundreds, if not thousands, of our decisions are made through that rubric.
So you're a marketing guy, an advertising guy, and you're at Wieden and Kennedy. This is a very prominent firm. So I'm curious if your path was a little bit like mine in the sense that, you know, let's it's 1992. I'm sitting here, you know, we're putting up a show, we're working on a show, and I see Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert improvise a scene, and I see what it does to the audience, and they're all laughing at the same time, and I'm like, huh, there's got to be some math behind that. There's got to be some science behind that. And I toke that away, and then I see that happen again with, like, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler or whatever, and not even people that we don't know those names. And you're working with major clients on major campaigns that are other people write business books about.
Yeah.
right? But then you take this or this sort of adjunct route, this other route inside academia. What, you know, where did that, was the thirst always there, or is this something that sort of evolved over time?
I wish that I was brilliant enough to have had a eureka moment like you, but I did not at any stretch. My eureka moment was more one of panic and desperation.
Wait, just as good.
Yeah, I just suppose. Yeah. I started as an engineer. I studied materials engineering because I thought the polymers were interesting. Mm-hmm. The fact that these carbon chains kind of come together because of their shared affinity for an electron, that they built these new structures, and because of these structures, new properties are able to manifest from their connections. And while that was interesting, I didn't necessarily love it. I didn't see myself doing that for the rest of my life. So I went into music and then found my way into business. And you know, fast forward a decade or so later, I'm working in advertising, running social. Like, I am the thought leader for social in an agency, a prominent agency called Translation, ran by a gentleman by the name of Steve Stout. And I'm the guy. I'm the social thought leader in the building. And my wife and I are at dinner with her friend from New York. And we're eating dinner, and her friend is a social worker. Mm-hmm. And throughout the whole conversation, she keeps saying, "Well, in social, we do this, and in social, we do that." And I'm like, why does she keep saying that? Because it's exactly what I say. In television, you do this, but in social, you do that. On radio, you do this, but in social, you do that. And it dawned on me, oh, she's saying that because social is people. Duh, Marcus. Social is people. Social work, social justice, social action. It's all people. And in that moment, it was like a Jerry Maguire moment for me. Mm-hmm. I had this huge epiphany. Social is people. And immediately it turned into dread because I realized I knew nothing about people. Nothing.
Really?
Other than what I experienced anecdotally, I knew the phrase Freudian slip. And I took social 101. Exactly right. I took social 101 in undergrad, and I practically slept through it. I say that with great shame. And as an engineer, you don't have to take a lot of humanities courses. The electives I took were all music theory courses, but I didn't know anything about people. And in that moment, I felt like a fraud. I told my wife, I'm going to get fired because I'm a fraud. Like, I knew everything about the technology because I viewed social as Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Foursquare. Those are the platforms at the time. And it was interesting, like, the irony of all this is that I had a slide that I'd often show in presentations that social is about people. Then I go all into the technology. And it's like, wow. Oh my goodness, it was staring right in front of me, you know, hiding in plain sight that I didn't understand people. So my wife, in her wisdom, she says, well, why don't you read about people? And I go, I don't read books. I read articles. It's stupid. So she handed me a book, Dan Ariely, Predictably Irrational, behavioral economist that she worked with before we met in business school. And it was his first book. And she's like, it's a great read. You should read it. Dan is great. So I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And I read it, and it rang a bell that I couldn't unring. And it changed my life. I mean, I tell Dan that now. Mm-hmm. We know each other, that like, you know, you've changed my life because I saw the world through lenses that I'd never seen before. And since then, I've just been in student posture trying to better understand people. And you're right. The fact that what happens with Stephen Colbert, what happens with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, these things are like what you said, it's mathematical, it's science. And as a creative, you know, in the creative industry, you know, we say, you know, it's jazz, not math. And they go, well, actually jazz is quite mathematical, actually.
Math. And actually, had someone taught me that jazz was math, very well in math.
I do well in math, and I'd be a better jazz player. It's, you know, it's these bifurcations that aren't real.
No, they're not real.
Once I remove these binaries, like, you know, we often say things in the world of practice, we'd say, oh, that works in theory. And I used to say that until I got a repertoire of theory and go, well, what do you mean? Like, everything is theoretical. Like, you know, we use theory for everything. The challenge is that we don't usually have good theory. That's why we have science. That's why we have people like the Dan Ariely's of the world who invest their lives into understanding the underlying physics of human behavior. And as we better understand it, we can leverage those things to get people to laugh, to buy, to download, to vote, to shop, to watch, to share. And as I understood these things, my work just got infinitely better. And I said, oh my goodness, this is it right here. This is the cheat code where these two worlds collide. You could be a better practitioner with a better understanding of theory of human behavior, and you probably be a better researcher with some understanding of how your research is applied. And that's the world I've been navigating for well over a decade now.
So this might blow your mind a little bit. Do you know who developed all the improv exercises and games that is the foundation of our work?
No, but blow me away.
She was a social worker. Her name was Viola Spolin. And her job was to better assimilate immigrant children coming into her care in the 20s and 30s at Jane Addams Hull House on the south side of Chicago. And when she didn't have immigrant kids, she took kids from the neighborhood and dragged them in to play these games.
Get out of town.
So listening, empathizing, communicating with more than just vocabulary, communicating with status, communicating in a group. What's two of you doing? What are six of you doing? And her son, Paul Sills, was studying at the University of Chicago, loved the games. He took the classes, taught those same games to people like Mike Nichols, Elaine May, Alan Arkin, Barbara Harris. They formed the first improvisational theater in America called the Compass Players in 57. That turns into the Second City in 1959. Same stuff that they were teaching and then translating into performance is all the stuff that, you know, Colbert, Bill Murray, Gilda Radner, Tim Meadows, Keegan-Michael Key, Jason Sudeikis, whatever, all of them. They all learn this thing, which is why they have that sort of language together around the work.
It's the cheat code. And when it's I look at the work that I am most proud of, I literally pulled them from theory. Launching the Brooklyn Nets, moving them from New Jersey to Brooklyn. That's Edward Bernays' propaganda theory, that you can unite a people by declaring an enemy of the state. United Brooklynites by declaring Manhattanites as the enemy.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. So you're at the agency and the Nets are moving from New Jersey to Brooklyn.
Exactly.
New owner.
So I'm at translation. We get the brief, new owner, the Russian, as he's referred to.
Russian oligarch.
Yeah. Right. So he buys the New Jersey Nets. Now, for context, New Jersey Nets isn't like a celebrated team. They're not a winning team. Nope. At best, they made it to a finals and got swept. Not a great team. And that team is coming over to New York, to Brooklyn. Now, if anyone knows anything about Brooklyn or about New York more broadly, they do not like exports from New Jersey, except for like Bon Jovi, Bruce Springsteen, and Billy Joel.
Maybe Billy Joel, yeah.
Right. And then we'll take Lauryn Hill, right? Like, it's like otherwise. Yeah. Like,
right? At least like, first album.
Exactly. So there's not a ton of like love for exports coming out of New Jersey into New York. On top of that, they're building a new arena in the Atlantic Terminal area of Brooklyn. This is like a very hallmark area of Brooklyn. And by building this arena, what we now know as Barclays, it's going to uproot a lot of local businesses, residents. It's a lot of unrest happening. So you got a bad team that no one wants from a place that no one at Brooklyn wants to be involved with this construction that's going to uproot the city. And people are pissed, to say the least. There's literally documentaries, protests, boycotts that we have to fight through. Now we got to make this team, as Brett Yarmark said, he wanted the Brooklyn Nets to be to Brooklyn what the Knicks are to Manhattan. Not an easy feat.
No. Very difficult.
So as we're looking at the value propositions, like most marketers would do, your razor sharper, your battery lasts longer, your car goes faster, your shampoo gives you body, whatever that means. We look at all the sort of compelling features and benefits of the team, and it goes, this isn't looking good. So we scrapped that and said, okay, what are we doing here? Like, we essentially want Brooklyn to accept this Brooklyn product, or this product that's going to be of Brooklyn, that is not of Brooklyn, this team. So how do we tap into something uniquely true to Brooklynites? And it's that Brooklyn Knights are extremely proud of themselves. You know, that saying, is Brooklyn in the house in hip hop? Like, that's a real thing. Yeah. They're very, very proud. So the idea is that that's the truth about this community of people. One, dare I say, this tribe of people who live in New York, in the New York five boroughs. How might we activate this pride in them, stoke the Brooklyn pride that exists in them? And I was like, oh man, let's pull from Edward Bernays' propaganda theory. He says that you can unite people by declaring an enemy of the state. And thankfully for us, at least, there is an inherent enemy to Brooklyn, and it's called Manhattan. the other island right across the bridge, Brooklynites have to schlep to Manhattan every single day during the work week and schlep back home. So much so, I used to live in Brooklyn at the time, that when you leave Manhattan on Friday night, you're done with Manhattan. I'll see you Monday morning. Trying to book plans with someone on the weekends who's from Brooklyn, and go, you're right, it's either Brooklyn or bust. So there's this inherent tension that we say, well, let's play with, let's stoke that. And that's, I mean, it was wildly successful for the launch of this campaign, very local in nature. Like, we use out-of-home billboards and a few tweets, but by and large, we just activated what was true, the cultural characteristics, the conventions and expectations of what it means to be a Brooklynite. And the idea is that if we could declare an enemy of the state, then people will use the Brooklyn Nets as a way to signify their residence to Brooklyn. It's a badge, a receipt of honor, receipt of identity that I'm a Brooklynite. Just so happens to be a basketball team. And, you know, yada, yada, yada. Fast forward literally 10 years later, people rep Brooklynite, the Brooklyn Nets really hard, even though the team isn't spectacular.
Yeah. So Second City's opening in Brooklyn. I don't know if you know this.
Oh, it's amazing. You need somebody to help you launch it? I got you.
No, no. So we were just kicking around titles. And one of them was Second City Not on Broadway, which I think would go into your, you know, version. And the other one was, we were trying to think if the Chicago thing is also going to be a thing. And one of the titles was Scenes from an Italian Beef Restaurant. Playing on the Billy Joel thing, and there's more, but it's interesting because it was very much, because Second City is literally named after a slight about Chicago from a New Yorker.
That's right. Writer. That's right.
So the idea of embracing that is inherent in our genes. It also made me think of, in my book, Yes And, we tell a story of when we were hired by the Department of Education by Arne Duncan during the Obama administration, and they had a big event where they were going to have sort of government folk, principals, and union folk together, teachers, none of whom like each other. And we were trying to find the uniting quality, because, of course, improvisation is very much about uniting. We couldn't find it. So then you turn to comedy, which is your theory, and also something inherent in comedy, because comedy, of course, my friend has a phrase, if it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower. So comedy can be used for evil.
Yeah.
In terms of finding an other. In this case, our other that we discovered that united all these three constituencies was educators from Finland.
Mm-hmm.
No one wanted to hear any more about Finns and their education. So we pretended we were, you know, these wild purple hair, and there were these Finnish educators. It became very clear it was Second City at a certain point, but, you know, bonded the people together, that they had this sort of common enemy, which is, again, this could be scary. You know, it's like great and fun the way we're talking about it, but it gets used even today in very nefarious ways.
Yeah, I talk about this in the book quite a bit. This idea that, you know, what we're talking about here, this idea of influence behavior based on harnessing the power of culture, it's value neutral. Like, it's not good or bad; just is. It is a part of our wiring as a species. We are social animals by nature.
Like bias,
observed of people. It is what we do, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you can use that for good or for bad. And I make that argument in the book that, like, with the more information you have, the more responsibility you have, to your point. So, like you said, it can be used for evil or for good. And I'm a firm believer that there's just so much that marketers can learn from comedians, just so much.
Sure. Yeah.
And you, I know you've seen this before. You've probably done this quite a bit, especially doing exec ed, that business folks go to improv lessons to learn how to communicate better, how to be more empathetic, how to listen, how to respond, how not to respond, how to listen but not wait to talk. Mm-hmm. I tell my clients and my students and my team this, that the best market researchers on the planet are comedians, full stop. Sure. I mean, they are amazing. You all are amazing. Mm-hmm. You essentially observe human behavior and you go, whoa, that was weird. You just look at people and go, huh, that was peculiar. Now, he did it and she did it and they did it and they're doing it. Okay, this is a thing, which essentially as a researcher, as a scholar, I go, oh, you are now bounding social phenomena.
Yeah.
This is a thing. It's happening. I'm seeing instances of this. Now, you ask yourself, comedians go, why is this happening? It essentially is applying theory to the social phenomenon you just observed. This is what scholars do. This is what I do in my scholarly research. Mm-hmm. Observe a phenomenon and figure out what is the underlying physics that's informing this thing. And comedians just have such a great repertoire of theory. Even they don't have the language to say it, they inherently know what it is just because of how empathetic you are as a discipline. And you go, oh, this is happening because of this underlying theory. Now, how do I say it in a way that gets people to see it in themselves? Or as Emily Dickinson puts it, tell all the truth, but tell it with a slant.
Yeah, that's right.
And you get on stage and you go, have you ever noticed that every time you go to the mall, you do blah, blah, blah. And we're all like, it's so me. Oh my
that's
God,
me. I see. Yeah, you see yourself. It's interesting. My wife, Anne, is a an academic. She's got tenure professor, and she runs the first ever BA in comedy writing and performance at Columbia College here in Chicago. So 4-year degree that you can get in comedy. And one of the things that she, because she did all this behavioral science work with me as well, is one of the things she talks about the difference between improvisers and stand-ups is that improvisers do a lot of perspective taking, you know, from the audience. So it's almost like a Nielsen rating system in terms of like, okay, what's on your mind? Great, great. And we're going to show it back to you. And now we know what that laugh is. The difference with stand-ups is they have to do perspective giving. The first 5 minutes of their act are letting the audience know how to watch them. And you name the stand-up you like, especially with the beginning special of their career, it's all what's wrong with them. Mm-hmm. So Patton Oswalt's a schlub, John Mulaney is a drunk, Amy Schumer is a slut, keep going down the list. And it is because we, and I talk about this a lot in my work, that we don't connect to your successes, we connect to your fiascos. Give me your struggle, you know? And that can be funny, but it also can be showing your resilience in terms of making it through. So leaders, when we talk about vulnerability and storytelling and what it means to be authentic, it's like, yeah, I know that sounds airy-fairy. It's not. It's actually gritty.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to be authentic.
Does.
I mean, you know this well, like comedians, like they all come from a very, very, very strong place of hurt, of like vulnerability. And like, I'm going to bare my soul to you right now.
Yeah.
Right. And then the audience actually comes to sort of go on that ride with you to like, it is very much, I mean, it's so similar to marketing communications in that it is discursive. That it's not like a person is delivering their either their stand up or their improv. It's not like I'm performing to an audience. The audience is a part of the discord and it's back and forth. And the same thing goes in marketing communications. We're not just shouting messages. At least good marketers aren't just shouting messages. They are entering the discourse with something meaningful to say. And as they enter the discourse based on how they see the world, the framing that they use to interpret the world, people go, oh, come on in, Ben and Jerry's. Yeah, like your point of view actually makes sense. Come sit at the table, be a part of this discourse. If not, it goes, oh, you just put a black tile up because everyone else is doing it. Please get away. And those things get disregarded. And I think that if we, whatever discipline you're in, we could all just benefit from being just a little bit more human.
Yeah, and you talk about this too in the book of like the reason – comedy doesn't work if there's no audience because there's no laughter. You don't know if it works. So comedians forever, I mean, you know, that's why Chris Rock and others work in small clubs to test out their act before they do the Netflix special. And so that sort of two-way communication has existed since the dawn of the art form and only recently has entered the conversation once, and not even at the beginning of social. I don't think, right, when you first started in social, I don't think even then people understood truly the dialogue that they were in until they got nailed and were like, oh, we are no longer in control.
That's right. That's right. And the interesting part is that it became evidence that we were never in control.
Well, that
that, you know, we were shouting messages out to the world because we essentially owned the media vehicles in which we communicated. They weren't back and forth. They were the only way that we knew they were working is when we saw sales go up, and we weren't, I would say, sophisticated enough to understand that a lot of this is just the power of media frequency that were driving sales, not connection to the brand, not people seeing themselves inside the brand in many ways. But then once these technologies help enable what naturally happens between people that we enter conversation and discourse, marketers say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. That's not what we intended. I said this, but that's not what I meant. And it's like, well, yeah, because you, marketer, don't make meaning. People do. You signal things to the world, then people go, oh, I see it that way, or, oh, I don't. And the more we understand that, the more important understanding culture becomes, because culture is the meaning-making system by which we see the world and translate the world, right? We see the world through our cultural lenses. That's why for some, a cow is leather, for others, it's a deity, and for some, it's dinner. Well, which one is it? It's all of them. Depending on who you're talking to. And if we walk into a scenario without understanding people's meaning-making frames, we say things that come off as racist, as objectifying women, as yada, 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 yada. You run the list on all the offenses that we've seen brands do. And social networking platforms just created the receipts by which we can be like, oh, when you said this on Tuesday, September 23rd, this is why we're roasting you now.
So the term identity politics has to make you laugh because you're like, what did you ever think it was?
That's right.
Right?
That's right. That's right.
Two things I want to talk about identity with you about. One's for me, one's for you. Okay. The one that's for me is, where did you get this Chicago hot dog story?
Oh, so I've always been fascinated by it. So I grew up in Detroit, born and raised.
Yep.
My grandparents grew up in Sycamore, Illinois. They lived in Sycamore, Illinois, right outside of DeKalb. My mother was born in Danville. And every Christmas, we would go to Chicago to go shopping at
the Marshall Fields, the tree.
We did the whole thing. It was the whole thing. Like I remember those things fondly. And sometimes we spend the summer in Sycamore with my grandparents, and we'd go into the city for the Taste of Chicago. Maybe we'll go, you know, here or there. And I remember no one ever having ketchup on their hot dogs. Yep. It's kind of always set in the recesses of my brain. And I saw this campaign from Heinz Ketchup some years back, where they tricked people into thinking that they made a new sauce that they called dog sauce. Mm-hmm. But it was really just ketchup under a different name.
Yep.
And people were like, this tastes so good. And once it was revealed that it was ketchup, people lost their minds. And one guy said, like, you're playing with our identities out here. And I thought it was just the most powerful thing.
They didn't want it.
That you would think that people would not do a thing because of the functional benefits or the functional consequences. Does it taste good? It doesn't last longer, doesn't go faster, or whatever value propositions. But really, we do these things habitually because of who we are, our identity. So like, I got to find this story. I got to know what the origin of this story was. And there it was. There's a guy.
Jimmy's Red Hots.
Red Hots. Exactly. He had a hot dog stand. And he said in the building, on the wall, said, don't even ask. No ketchup. Don't even ask for it.
That was just him.
Just him. But out of that comes now a cultural norm for Chicagoans. And if you move to Chicago and you go, I'm a Chicagoan now, you go, I guess I don't do this. And it's so interesting how once we affix our identity to a thing, how quickly we adopt the culture.
It's important. It's important. Okay. And this one's for you. Also slightly for me in the sense that my boss, Ed, is a graduate of the University of Michigan.
Oh, awesome. Go Blue.
And I have no dog in this. I mean, my wife went to Northwestern. But I don't like if I'm hanging my, shingle on that, that's not good. So, but you people are out of your minds. I mean, he got my friend Abby, who left here, not because of this, went to Ohio State. And the two of them, I looked at some of these texts. They were not, HR would have had a field day.
It's so true, man. I was at an agency that I will not name, and we were meeting with the Schottensteins. So if you don't know the Schottensteins,
yeah,
they are a big deal in Columbus, Ohio. They own DSW, Value City Furniture, American Eagle. Like they own all that. Like they like their distribution is connected to the airport in Columbus. Like that's how important these guys are. And you know, me in my naivete, we go down there for a meeting. We're like pitching them, and most of my slides I use references from my life because that's how I get into it. So I have all these Michigan references, like it's literally like seven different Michigan references in this deck. And we walk in the front door. There's a like gargantuan, huge Ohio State chair. Like, and I'm like, is this gonna be a problem? But like, come on, we're adults. Like, we are adults. This is a business.
It was totally a problem. It'll
be an issue. So, I mean, I just kind of wrote it off. Like, sure, Columbus, of course, they'll have Ohio State paraphernalia. No big whoop. We go into the meeting. It gets to my part. We get to my part, and I think I'm on like slide 10, and there's a Michigan reference. And this kind of like in jest, ha ha ha. Oh, I know you didn't put a Michigan reference there. Ha ha ha. By like slide 17, when we get to like the fifth reference, they literally like, please stop now. Like, mm-hmm. Stop. So I was like, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. So we literally jump past my section because they were offended. And yep. It just seems so, it's odd for me because I have shifted my identity from being a student, which at that time I did have a lot of contentment for Ohio State. But now being a professor, I go, oh, it's just an academic institution. My allegiance is just different. But when I identified as a Michigan Wolverine, oh my goodness, just so much anger and frustration when it came to Ohio State for schools that I was indifferent about before I went to Michigan. I mean, this is just how powerful our identities are. I mean, it changes everything about us, and culture is foundationally established upon our identity. Because of who we are, we see the world a certain way. And the way we see the world informs how we behave in the world and the cultural production that we take in. They become ways by which we express our way of seeing the world through music, art, film, brands, and branded products.
And then I think the leap that you take quite naturally is when we've got these identities, but universally what we know, and Dan Gilbert talks about this among others, is we share a lot of the same stuff, whether it's love, family, you know, all these sort of these sort of big, broad ideas of the things that we sort of buy into. And in your section on preaching the gospel, you talk about brands that get very smart about what they're selling. And that in that, and I thought, here's the one that I thought was the most interesting, because I broke this down with my son the other day, which was, you talk about Coca-Cola selling happiness, mm-hmm. which 100%. Like, we all know, if you don't know the Coke story, you've seen Mad Men, you know. I mean, this is like, they have done this very early on. And I, who do not really care for soft drinks or have soft drinks in my house, if I'm going out for like an Italian beef with my son, I will get a Coke. And I get the Coke because it feels like it's going to make me happy. And it is sugar water.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
But like, I don't know, I can't control it. It's how I feel. And I was sort of like, and I just be honest too. I was sort of like, what does Second City sell? Because yeah, I was sort of like, you know, there's laughter, there's shared laughter. And I said, is it happiness? And my son goes, no, because it's not just laughter, because it's the kind of, at Second City, it's a laugh that when you're driving home, you realize was a little bit deeper and a little bit sadder than maybe you thought it was. So it makes you think. And I'm like, yeah, but and I don't have the thing to sort of distill it. But I imagine for any entity, for any brand, for the University of Michigan, even, it's what is that thing? And it probably is, while multifaceted, still kind of one thing.
Yeah. So there is like one governing sort of North Star that informs everything we do. And to your point, who doesn't want to be happy? Well, actually, not everybody wants to be happy. That's true. But like, but by and large, the majority of us want some happiness, some joy. And we may get happiness out of being miserable. We all kind of want some joy. But the way joy manifests is different for all of us, right? And we find people who like things who are like ourselves. For instance, I love toilet humor. Love, love, mm-hmm. love it. Can't get enough. not my wife's cup of tea, but me all day long. Give me Sarah Silverman. Give me Eddie Murphy. Like, give me those. Like, give me those guys. I want them all day long. Family Guy all day long. Mm-hmm. My wife, not so much her. We both like to laugh. We both like comedy. But the idea is clicking down to the idiosyncratic characteristics that govern people like us. So my wife and I, who clearly are married and we are a partnership, we have to agree on something that both of us kind of like.
Yeah.
Right. But with my other people, we watch other things. So our consumption behaviors become byproducts of who we are beyond just the surface thing, but the thing that clicks down into the nuances of us.
What's
but
your
the,
compromise comedy?
Say it again.
What's your compromise comedy between you and your wife?
Rom-coms.
Oh, okay.
Romantic comedy. You can't go wrong. You can't go wrong.
Like a Park and Rec maybe, or a 30 Rock?
30 Rock for sure. We okay. are big on 30 Rock. Succession. Not Succession, but Succession.
No, I do love Succession.
Succession's so good. I was thinking Succession. I was thinking Insecure.
Insecure, sure.
Yeah. So we find, but they're always like something romantic.
But what I'll say though, 30 Rock being, because I've analyzed this a lot, but that does combine some of those taboo stuff that you like, they're playing with, that's underneath the comedy, with these rich sitcom tropes that are classic, that are very easy to understand, that also work in a story sort of level. So that's a very unique property. And there's not a lot of stuff like that. And
the powerful part about this is that even though my wife and I love her to death, clearly she's my wife, that when I see something, I know what to share with her and what not.
Right. Yep.
And this is just the powerful part for brands, for entities, for organizations or institutions that want to activate the network effect that comes from propagation, that people do the segmenting for you, that you tap into people who see the world the way you do, who abide by the same meaning system that you do, not at a high level, but at a very nuanced level, that people go, oh, that's awesome. I'm going to show Kelly that because I know he's going to love it. I'm not going to show my wife that because I know that she won't. Yep. And what happens is that I share it with you, then you share it with someone who's like us, and then so on and so on and so on. And my wife will end up seeing it later down the road just to be socially included. That's why I watched 10 hours of Tiger King. Not because I'm into big cats, it's not my thing, but I want to be a part of the discourse. I want to know what the memes are all about. So I watched it because everyone else was doing it. So you start with the collective of the willing, activate those people, and then they go tell other people. And as they tell other people, the people who are on the periphery that are late to the party, they'll show up just because nothing draws a crowd like a crowd.
Have you run across, he's from the, I think his seminal work was written in 1959, Irvin Goffman.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
Goffman's work was really, especially for someone who grew up in theater, to me, to have this idea of your onstage, your offstage, your backstage personality, that you're not schizophrenic. You're right. Many selves. That's and right. Again, Whitman told us this, you know, as well. Well, before that. But, you know, I find that I think as human beings, we are reluctant to acknowledge that because it is complex. And it also means like when people are being like, you can't be your authentic self at work. It's like, yeah, we're not saying show up in your pajamas. What we're saying is you talk a certain way to your parents that is different than the way you talk to your friends. And you're probably going to lean more on the parent side than the friend side when you're talking to your boss.
That's right. And it depends on to Guffman's point, you know, what character you choose to play.
Yeah.
Because of the character, my identity that I choose to play, I don certain customary. I adhere to a certain script, how I talk. I behave based on what the character is supposed to be, on what the audience expects of me. Cooley, another sociologist, refers to this as the looking glass theory, that I'm not who I think I am. I'm not who you think I am. I am who I think you think that I am, right? So that our identities are socially constructed. And once we decide on what character we're going to play, we navigate the world through these shared expectations of people like me. And to your point, we go, oh, man, I can't be myself here because I'm not playing the character that I play when I'm outside these walls. And you go, well, sure, you could play the same character, but like just change your outfit. It's like, you know, like you can still be you. Like I'm still me when I go to the church sanctuary. I'm just wearing a suit as opposed to wearing a sweatsuit if I were going to play basketball. I'm still Marcus. And that's where authenticity comes into play. Yeah. And no matter the context, I am myself. I am the same character, as it were, whether it's backstage, front of stage, or outside the mezzanine. And once we adhere to a certain character and identity, and we show up like that character and all of its conventions and expectations, people go, he's just so real. That's why everybody loved Cardi B when she first came out.
Yeah.
It's like, my goodness, this woman, it don't matter where she is, she could be with the president, with Jimmy Fallon, or, you know, on a video set with Megan Thee Stallion, she going to be Cardi B. And we love that, because a part of us all want to be that courageous, to be ourselves.
I mean, this is the nerdy thing that where I really was jiving with your book, because as you're seeing that and you're applying it to your professional job, I'm guessing, but I think I'm right, you apply it to your personal life like I do with mine.
Totally.
So Heather Caruso, who I co-led the Second Science Project with, introduced me to William Swan's self-verification theory, which is this idea of, you know, that, you know, we think everyone wants to be seen like their best self, but actually they want to be seen as they see themselves. And we're such tricky people. We don't always teach people how we see ourselves, because it can be a bit embarrassing. So if I see myself as clumsy, it's really important you see me as clumsy so you don't throw me a ball.
That's right. That's right.
But if I don't tell you, what are you doing? And so when we are teaching at Second City the need to be others focused with someone on stage to get to their want as you're creating a scene, the idea that there is a want behind the want is this idea of like, that is the crux of the best kind of comedy, where it's like, I totally saw this coming. I thought I saw this coming. I did not see this coming. And it's like the rug is pulled out. Exactly. Right. And all great art is that way. It's this revelation of the human condition, which is how I think art kind of started in the first place when there weren't cameras.
That's the slant that Emily Dickinson talks about, right? It's the slant. It's the truth. It's like, oh, you see me, you see the world the way I do. And oh man, I couldn't even put it in words like that. Yep. Like, wow, I'd actually think about that. That's a true thing. Wow, you got me. And that feeling of getting got, being seen, being understood, I mean, I don't think there's anything in this world more powerful.
No.
That. I mean, it is, to me, it's a manifestation of feeling loved. That, like, you see me for who I really, really am. Yeah. And our closest, the people closest to us are the ones who make those revelations to us. You know, they go like, you notice every time this happens, you do this. You go, really, I do that? And you go, you do it all the time. You go, wow, you must have been really paying attention to me. Thank you. Because we walk around this world feeling like no one sees us. Like we're just waiting to kind of chime in just so that we can be seen. But if someone can observe us being what we believe is ourselves, when there are no sort of curation needs to happen, where we feel like we have to be a certain thing, which is kind of ourselves, and people see us, it's a really powerful thing, and it creates connection. At the end of the day, we are social animals by nature. We're just trying to crash into each other, because in our minds, according to anthropologists, that's how we're able to survive.
Yeah, it's all about the relationships.
It's all about that. So being seen, whether it's I'm on a stage and I'm doing improv with someone, whether it's my relationship with someone and they're like, hey, you okay? Because I notice when it happened, like I saw your body clench up. Like, you saw that? Like, yeah, man, I felt this way. Whew, thank you. And for a marketer to see people, not based on the boxes that we put them in, these demographic makeups, but based on who they are, their identity, their cultural subscription, they go, man, these guys just get me. That's a brand for me, not because of what it is, but because of who I am. And that just requires a tremendous amount of empathy, cognitive empathy that we don't practice enough of, which is why with my girls, I have an 8-year-old, a 3-year-old, Georgia and Ivy, respectively, whenever they hurt my feelings, and they do often, because I'm an emotional guy, I'll be honest, I'm being vulnerable with you here.
I'm an emotional guy. I
tell my daughter, I never say to them, how do you think that, how would you feel if I did that to you? Because that's practicing an affective empathy, the golden rule, do unto others you want done unto you. Instead, I say to them, how do you think you made daddy feel? Because I want them to start seeing the world through lenses that aren't their own.
That's smart.
Through lenses that aren't their own. Because if they do that, they will be better at almost everything they do in this world. If they're able to connect with people at a very central core level of who they are, no matter what field you're in, they'll be able to navigate the world in a way better than I could ever could.
Yeah, 1,000%. I could talk to you all day, but we don't have all day. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. So it's just a time in your life and work or home or wherever that you normally would have said no, which a lot of us do all the time, but instead you said yes and. Do you have a story for us?
Sure. When I decided to pursue academia along with practice, so living those two worlds, someone said to me, you should teach classes, not just one class on the weekends, but maybe you should teach and do work at the same time. And I go, you're right. Yes, comma, and I'm gonna go get a doctorate. I'm gonna get my union card here. So I went and got a doctorate while I was teaching and while I was working, and we just had a new kid, much to my wife's chagrin. But I just felt like if I was gonna do it, I'm gonna do it the highest fidelity possible. Cause I feel like that's why I exist. I just thought about what is Second City all about? What do these brands exist? Why does Coke exist for happiness? I exist to help people realize the best versions of themselves. And hopefully, prayerfully, inshallah, this book is a way to sort of scale that in a way to help people, reach the highest fidelity possible.
Yeah, and I think it absolutely is. The book is called For the Culture, the power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. Marcus Collins, thank you for coming on the pod.
Oh, thank you. This is so much fun.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Ben Anderson from WGN, and we get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.